We are going to discuss the science of generosity this hour. And we'll explore how generous we are as Americans. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. According to a generosity survey, two-thirds of Americans believe it's important to be generous. Yet, almost half of the U.S. population actually gives no money to charity at all. Why do relatively few people give a lot while most of us give little or nothing? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. How important is generosity to you? What motivates you to donate to a charity? What are some of the ways in which you like to give? And which causes or charities do you think are particularly deserving of your generosity? We would love to hear from you. Our guest is Patricia Snell-Herzog, co-investigator on the Science of Generosity Initiative, assistant professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Arkansas, and co-author of American Generosity, Who Gives and Why. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for joining us. So how do you define generosity?
We define generosity as an inclination to do good for others that can be manifested in a variety of forms.
All right.
So it's pretty broad, and we look at, we in the book look at a total of 9 different, what we think of as expressions of generosity.
All right. So it's more than just writing a check out to a charity?
It is. That's one of them, charitable donations. But we also look at volunteering, taking political action for charitable causes, and also blood donation, organ donation, estate giving, lending possessions to people, especially lending to give, as in lending when you think you won't get the possession back, and then relational forms of generosity that are informal ways that people help each other, like watching people's children for them or helping with a house project at their neighbor's house, that kind of thing.
So in the book you say generous behaviors are intended to enhance the well-being of others. That's the crux. It benefits others?
Right, that's the key aspect. It's at least intended to benefit others. And we focus on the intention and not so much, kind of looking at the impact part of it.
Oh, I see. Sure, because you might think it's going to be good, but it may not be good.
Right.
So why are people generous? You know, why do people give?
Well, the interesting thing is we in the book, as you were just opening up with, talk about kind of a half full and a half empty, glass half empty perspective. And we start off with the glass half empty aspect that not a lot of people do give if you look at any one form of giving. And so, like you said, a lot of people think it's a very important it's very important to be a generous person, but then only 45% have given money to a charitable cause in the past year. Only 75% have volunteered for a charitable cause within the last month, and 75% have not done that. 40% have not. 45% have not given to a charitable cause.
Let's start with that in terms of. Why so many of us don't give at all? It might on the surface be, hey, you don't have enough money to share, but it's more than that?
Right. So that's the first kind of puzzle that we run into in the book in terms of exploring sort of the common sense notion that, well, maybe people aren't giving money because they don't have money to give away. And so we look at this through a few ways. One is to look at giving as a percentage of income. And when you look at it as a percentage of income, it's not the wealthiest who give the greatest proportion. And I think that's one of those things that people have in mind. I hear it a lot in interviews with people. It facilitates kind of a free rider effect in terms of why people don't give, because they think there's somebody else out there doing it for them. And it turns out that's not necessarily the case. Some people proportionally are giving the greatest amounts at the lowest income levels.
And so what do we know about those people who are giving the money, even if they're at the lowest income levels?
Well, we look at a variety of explanations throughout the course of the book. And so in Chapter 2, we talk about a number of demographic aspects that relate in terms of gender and race and ethnicity and a whole variety of other factors along those lines, including regional location. And the interesting thing that is possible in this study is the fact that we look at so many different kinds of giving allowed us to be able to look at kind of regional specialties and the way that people give. And what we found, for instance, is that giving to charitable causes is much more common in the West. In the western portion of the United States, in terms of financial giving, and that people there are more likely to give and give in greater amounts of dollars in the West, whereas the Northeast tended to kind of specialize in both volunteering and political action, but in an interesting way, in the sense that more people are involved in volunteering and taking political action, but give fewer amounts of hours when they do it.
Interesting. What do we do in the Midwest more so than others?
So the Midwest tends to be more of what I think of as a generalist, where if you look at any one of those three, what we call the big three giving forms, the financial giving, volunteering, and political action, they're not high on the list on any one of those three, but you look at all three together, and they are the highest. In terms of rates of participation. So if you look at, you know, people can kind of express their generosity through any one of those three forms, then the Midwest has a high rate of participation.
So let me understand that correctly. You're saying that we have the highest participation of the different forms of generosity than the rest of the country.
Highest rate of participation in the big three combined, so doing any one of those three.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so is it something in our water?
Probably not so much, although there. So the thing with the Midwest and some of the other findings I just reported is that once we control for a lot of the demographic differences that associate with region of the country, most of those rates are no longer statistically significant, which means it's probably due to the demographic differences between regions. The only one that is not the case for is in the South, the fact that so the South tends to show up lower, and that's where I am. So the South tends to show up lower on all those measures, except for among people who volunteer, spending a greater amount of hours volunteering. And that one it remains statistically significant after we control for all the demographic factors. So it seems like there may be something kind of more cultural or in the water, if you will.
Interesting, interesting. So, I mean, do we know why, for example, in the Northeast, there are higher rates of participation in volunteering and political action?
Right. So I think that the main part of the book that helps to answer the why questions are chapters 4 and 5, where we talk about, in chapter 4, we look at a whole range of social psychological characteristics. And in chapter 5, we look at relational supports that people have. And this leads us in the conclusion to formulate a theory that we call the circles of generosity that I really think helps to explain that Northeast effect. And we have a case study who is our classic Northeasterner who lives in the D.C. area, and he is a heavily, heavily involved in the political community there. And so I'll use him as an example to explain our statistical findings, where what happens is there's a lifestyle, a kind of professional lifestyle that takes place for some people where he's an accountant, for instance, who makes a good amount of money off of clients who are involved in the political community. Then he also gives a lot of political action to various causes that those clients may be involved in. And so there's this, for the more affluent folks that we talk to, there's this kind of reciprocal relationship with volunteering and taking political action and even giving to charitable causes, where it actually kind of supports their professional identity.
Yeah. Well, you know, we had we recently had our pledge drive, our winter membership drive here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and it is really humbling to see how people will come through to support Wisconsin Public Radio. I mean, you don't have to pay for this, but people will call in or go online and donate money to us. And a lot of people will do this, and a lot of dollars are donated to help listener-supported radio. What do we know about why? And again, this is just an example why somebody would say, "Okay, I'm gonna give $10 a month to my local radio station, public radio station."
Right. So one of the best explanations for that is that many people in Chapter 5, we talk about how the different kinds of social supports that people have are where they learn to do this and where they get support for it. So when we see that kind of big drop-off between the two-thirds who believe it's important to be generous and then the large proportion of people who don't do what they think they want to be doing, a lot of that has to do with not having kind of the social support system that we see our givers have. And so one of the classic supports for giving that people talk about is learning to give from their parents. And a lot of people learn from a young age from their parents. They saw them giving to some kind of cause or volunteering for that cause, and then they... And sometimes they never even really had conversations about it with their parents, but they just saw it, and they learned to model that in. And so, and many people continue to support the same kind of organizations that their parents did. And so it becomes part of just their identity and their family lifestyle. But then there are people for whom that didn't happen, that they still learn to be givers too, by being around friends who are really involved and who are asking them, sometimes a coworker, you know, asking if they want to get involved in a cause. And the other thing is having spouses who are interested in giving. And so we see that even if somebody doesn't think it's important to be a generous giver to a cause, if their spouse does, they're more likely to do it. And sometimes begrudgingly, but they kind of, you know, will participate anyway. And then the other aspect of it, interestingly, is that oftentimes people who have grown up, even if they're no longer a religious attender, but if they grew up in a going to a congregation with their family, they sometimes had that visual symbolic imagery of basically seeing people donate into the offering plate, again, even their parents, and that has kind of they reflect back on that as an important indicator to them that this was a good thing to do, even if they're no longer participating in a religious organization.
We are talking with Patricia Snell Herzog, co-investigator of the Science of Generosity Initiative. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Arkansas, and she is the co-author of American Generosity, Who Gives and Why? And that's what we're talking about. Who gives to charitable causes, who donates their time, who takes political action to try to benefit someone else. Why do you give? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. And how do you give? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking with the co-author of American Generosity, Who Gives and Why? And we're welcoming your questions, and we're welcoming your own experiences and your answer to that question. Who do you give to and why? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Patricia Snell Herzog, and our first caller is Forrest in Rolling Ground. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, go ahead.
Hey, yeah, I just wanted to comment. I work for a small nonprofit organization myself called Crawford Stewardship Project, and we're based in a relatively low-income rural area, and I have been really impressed year after year at the amount of support our organization gets and the amount of generosity that comes forward from people with not a lot of money, largely, and it really allows our organization to take on what we think is important and not rely on the larger donors. And I wanted to comment on something you said about, is it something in our water that makes people generous? And my take on that is a little different. There's actually, there are serious issues that motivate people to donate as well, and issues with drinking water, issues with really basic things like that is certainly a motivating factor that I see people donating, and in my own donation, I look at that as well.
Well, thank you, Forrest. And yeah, I was just kind of making a little bit of a joke about whether there was something in our water, but if you want to protect the water and you want to clean up the water and or keep it safe, that would be a big motivator, Patricia.
Absolutely. I think this is a great point. And clearly there are a number of causes that people care deeply about. And one of the things that I found really interesting in the course of doing this research was that people can take action on that in a variety of ways, you know, and so sometimes they're giving money and sometimes they're volunteering, sometimes they're taking political action or doing one of the other forms, but yes, oftentimes, especially in our planned, what we call the planned and habitual givers, the people who have this kind of really patterned into their ongoing day-to-day life, are very motivated by the causes that they're invested in.
Yeah. What exactly is the Science of Generosity Initiative?
It's a larger project of which this research was one aspect. It included a request for proposals where we received proposals from around the world and funded other researchers to carry out investigations at other universities as well. And then this was a portion that was funded through the University of Notre Dame, and where we collected a national survey of 2,000 Americans, which is mostly what we're reporting on in the book, and then also from that survey did in-person interviews that were very in-depth with 40 families, 40 different households, where if there was a spouse or a romantic partner, we interviewed them as well.
Yeah. And what is the mission, though, of the Science of Generosity Initiative?
The mission is to create a field of generosity, because one of the problems or the needs that we saw is that this is a topic that gets explored interdisciplinarily in all sorts of different fields, but there are barriers to reading each other's work, even though we're interested in the same topic. So there are all sorts of interesting studies that go on, you know, by studying the brain and figuring out what's happening with generosity in terms of which parts of our brain are activated, or by looking at early childhood studies in terms of how people learn to give, or by looking at cross-national aspects of how, you know, political structures in different countries relate to giving. And
are you trying to, and I guess, is there any thought that we want to mold Americans to be a more giving and charitable nation?
Well, certainly. I think we see a great deal of untapped potential in the American public, because we are a nation, as we said, who is very interested in being generous, but then don't wind up carrying that out as much as we seem to want to. And so what we saw was, even if, you know, a handful of people give a great deal more annually than they used to, or if a lot of people give a dollar more, there could be a great deal that is available for charitable causes.
Let's take another call from Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. First off, I want to just say yay for Forrest and the Crawford Stewardship Project, Forrest, who called earlier. It's a great group. I do give money and time to groups like Crawford Stewardship, including that group. But I wanted to bring up a different issue, which is that in this country, the way charity is run is basically as a scam to help the rich avoid paying taxes while getting a tax-free way toolbox for influencing public policy. And it's so much of what we used to pay for publicly with taxes is now being paid for by foundations, funded by the rich. And just a quick example, if you look at the work the Gates Foundation does in public schools, where public schools, a lot of public schools have come to rely on donations for the Gates Foundation for basic material costs that used to be picked up by taxpayers in a progressive taxation from income taxes and somewhat from property taxes. But the Gates Foundation has its own agenda of pushing school privatization and charter schools and school vouchers and that sort of thing, sort of anti-public school reforms. And that's the sort of thing that the way we do charity enables in this country. I've never been able to itemize my taxes because I don't make enough income, and I give anyway. But those who can, the way the tax system is set up is to favor the rich, you know, avoiding taxes by paying charity costs.
Professor Herzog, what's your response to that?
I definitely think that that's a portion of what happens in the giving spectrum. I also think that there are a number of small grassroots organizations that people support as well. In fact, I think WPR is a great example of something that wouldn't be that kind of a giving mechanism that is just supporting the interests of the most wealthy. So I think the interesting thing is that giving through charitable organizations has been part of this country's history in terms of how everyday Americans can also participate with a stronger voice by grouping up and asserting their interests as well.
Can you tell us how tax write-offs encourage generosity or not, whether or not we could encourage more charitable contributions if that was more generous in some way?
We actually did not come across that a great deal. The one type of giving that we're really talking about here where that is more common is that professional lifestyle giving that happens among the most affluent. Nobody in that group really talked to us about tax write-offs being their main motivation, but it certainly could help. I think that it's also just part of that kind of broader professional lifestyle where they do tend to talk about it and in terms of, various ways that they benefit from participating in giving. But people across the whole socioeconomic spectrum actually talk about that as well, just in different ways, so it's not the tax write-off or the things that directly benefit their business life, but they talk about the joy that they give out of giving. And so that's why part of our effort in calling this generosity as opposed to what's more commonly used is the term altruism, is that that assumes that it's completely other-oriented and that the giver doesn't also benefit. But actually, many people talk about various kinds of benefits that they get out of giving. So, I think that certainly for people who are at the highest income brackets that giving can make that tangible difference. But when you look at the religious and community giving and the relationship kind of giving and even those at the, most impoverished level in terms of the self-sufficiency giving, they are oftentimes motivated by helping the people most immediately around them or the community that they feel really a part of. And so I don't know that tax breaks would necessarily make a difference for them.
Generally, how much do people give as a percentage of their income?
Well, it's really variable across the spectrum. The highest amounts of giving as a percentage of income tend to be at the lower, kind of not the lowest, but low middle. And overall, it's about it really kind of varies between somewhere between 3% and about 40 to 60% of their income.
Yeah. Does this come from the same place, perhaps? There's an old saying that people who were once worked in a restaurant as wait staff are the best tippers. They know what it's like, and so therefore they they give a higher tip, whereas somebody who's in a low middle income knows how hard it is to struggle, therefore they give more to a cause.
Absolutely. There are plenty of people. In fact, what was fantastic about doing the qualitative interview part of this study was that we had a section on questions that asked about being a recipient of generosity. And many people at the lower income levels talk about as it's kind of a shared effort of, you know, I might be down on my luck at some point and somebody else might be helping me out, and then later on I might have a little to give and I might be helping them out. And so there certainly is an aspect where many people who don't have a lot don't necessarily cling to it the same way that we sometimes see among people who actually have more. And the interesting thing is that if you ask people, you know, do you feel like you have enough resources to give, some people who have the most amount of resources that anyone we've interviewed don't think they have enough.
Yeah. Let's go to Mike in Chicago next. Hello, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking the call. My personal, background on this is it comes from faith for my wife and I on how we've given over the years, and we've increased our giving because we've been blessed with, you know, our income combined with my wife and I. We make a pretty good living, and it's not what I'd consider rich by any means, but when you're able to do that, an interesting thing happens, though, when you do give over time, and I'm talking some decades here, and if you're able to increase it and that type of thing, is that you find that you want to do more. And that's really what's happened to my wife and I. And you want to branch off with different things. And it's included supporting a child in Africa with his family through an international organization. I don't know if you want me to name names or not, but, we've had the blessing of supporting them and finding out that for just a small amount of money per month, like $35, you're actually supporting a child and his family in Africa for a whole year, based on their entire lifestyle. So it gives me a perspective with my wife on really the disparity of what we have in this country compared to what other people live on in other nations, that they don't need hardly as much to sustain the type life of being able to live from day to day and sustenance like that. But again, I go back to this, but if I could just interject one thing from the gentleman that just called based on what he said about Mr. Gates, I guess the question that I would have is, where else would he want us to put the money? Or what would you tell Bill Gates to do with his money? I can pretty much disagree with what he came across with there, saying that, contributing to schools and that. I think he's had some wonderful ideas and how that money is distributed. I know he's got a say in it.
Right. And I don't want to get too far afield. And Mike, why don't you, I think our guest was saying, that caller was saying that that he wished government and taxpayer support funded public schools and not charitable donations.
That's a whole other talk, too. Though.
Yeah, but Mike, you can give a shout out to this this organization that you contribute to sponsor child. That's fine.
Yeah, it's Compassion International, and we've been doing that for about 7-8 years. My daughter did it for quite a while, too, until the little boy in Mexico she supported, he became of age and that type of thing. It's a wonderful organization. And the other thing you look at is how much money are those organizations giving to the actual cause? And people have to do their homework on that, too.
Oh, yeah, that's true, too. And a lot of good points. So thank you very much, Mike. Patricia, talk some about, he said a lot of his giving comes from faith and I believe his church. And that's and the more he gives, the more he wants to give.
Right, and he couldn't be a better representation of what we call the habitual giver in chapter 3, where this is exactly a story that's shared by many people in terms of really finding motivation to give from participating in a religious community, and oftentimes people mention believing in a tithe or something like a percentage of giving, and so what happens often with the habitual givers is they work in a certain percentage into the background and don't really give any kind of conscious thought to it. But then many of the folks that we interviewed in this category talk about then giving on top of that they just kind of think of that as a baseline. And they may do that to their religious congregation, they may do it to a combination of nonprofit organizations and religious congregations, but then they often contribute to, you know, the exact same kind of organizations that the caller mentioned in terms of donating above and beyond that kind of percentage baseline that they've already worked in as a habit.
Let's go next to Bill in Janesville. Hello, Bill.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
A lot of people have brought up a lot of very detailed points. I think I'd try to simplify it by saying that it boils down to just a sense of empathy. And I think your guest kind of hit on that. I know Sam Harris is a neuroscientist, has talked about this. There are ways to identify people who have more empathy than others. I don't know if there's an actual gene for it, but as she mentioned, you give or share or help because you understand the struggle of the other.
So it comes down to a basic sense of empathy, Patricia?
Empathy is definitely part of it. In fact, that is exactly the kinds of social psychological orientations that we look at in Chapter 4. And what we find is that there are a variety of different kinds of factors, some of which relate to one type of giving more than another. And empathy is very important for any kind of interpersonal, relational kind of giving, where there is more of this direct connection to the recipient of the giving. Whereas some other people give in a kind of more abstract way, you know, where they're giving to, they think of organizations more as the recipient of their giving. And so it's a little bit different process there. It's more of the what we end up calling kind of collective consciousness and social solidarity aspects. But they do all entail a degree of other orientation.
We are talking with Patricia Snell Herzog, co-investigator on the Science of Generosity Initiative, assistant professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Arkansas, co-author of American Generosity, Who Gives and Why? And we are welcoming your questions for her about generosity, the science of generosity. And we're wondering, who do you give to and why? And how do you give? Is it writing a check, or is it volunteering, or political action, or some other way? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. And when we come back, we'll talk about what we can do if we want to cultivate more generosity, either in ourselves or maybe in our children. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about generosity and just how generous are Americans really? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Talking about how two-thirds of us believe it is important to be generous, yet almost half of the U.S. population does not give to charity at all. And we're wondering why that is, talking about the different types of generosity, talking about what motivates generosity, welcoming your questions for our guest, Patricia Snell Herzog, who is the co-author of American Generosity, Who Gives and Why. Brittany in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Brittany.
Hi, I'm so excited that I'm on the air.
Well, thank you for calling.
I just wanted to mention, throughout my life, my family has always been, they always donated to causes that they found important. I carried that with me through college, leaving college and starting a family, it was hard to donate a lot of money and time. And it wasn't until last summer when my husband was diagnosed with thyroid cancer that we really started regularly contributing to an organization. And so it was after that, we regularly make contributions to an organization called THYCA, which is the Thyroid Cancer Survivor Association. What really prompted us to make those regular contributions was just the fact that they had impacted our lives so much, and they really helped us to navigate, the cancer treatments and the struggles and kind of moving forward in life. So,
I understand completely.
So that's what made us, kind of start making those regular contributions and instead of just, you know, contributing here and there.
Well, let me get our guest to respond to that. I mean, sometimes we don't know about a cause until it hits us smack in the face, Patricia.
Absolutely. And Brittany, is your husband doing well now?
Yeah, he's coming up on his 6 months, 6 months after his treatment, and things are going well. And it's just really been, it was a difficult thing to go through, but really it was just a blessing for our family. So many good things came out of it, and he's doing great. So
I'm glad to hear that.
That's fantastic. And I do think this is exactly where I want to head with this research next, is hearing so many stories like yours in terms of, you know, you had that kind of baseline to give, right? You said you grew up knowing that it was important, but then it took this life course event, something that kind of altered the way things have been going, to really sort of activate it for you. And that's where we heard a lot of that in this study, but the way the study was designed, we didn't keep in touch with the same people over time. It's called a longitudinal study, and that's what I'm really interested in doing next, because I love hearing those stories of how it kind of changes and evolves over the life course.
Yeah. Brittany, I'm glad your husband is doing well. I wish you both the very best. You also told my producer that you have since adopted a puppy, and you also donate to the Humane Society or wherever you got the puppy.
Yeah, so there's actually a local boxer rescue group. It's called the RSBR Boxer Rescue and Sanctuary. They're actually located in Wallace, Michigan. And we, after my husband's treatment, we decided that we, would kind of help them out when they needed it. So we had fostered for them before, we eventually decided we were fostering one little puppy, and we just loved her so much we decided to keep her, so we adopted her.
Yeah. Well, good luck. What's her name?
Her name is Ginger.
Ginger. Well, best wishes to your entire family. Boy, I don't know if I wouldn't be able to foster, I don't think, Patricia. I would be adopting all of them, too.
I know. We just had a rescue in the local area. There was something had gone on where there was 100 and some puppies that were rescued. And so, there's lots of people in the area taking some in. And I think many people are taking in a number of them and thinking about, you know, just finding other homes for them. But, it'd be hard not to just want to keep them. So
what do we know about how to encourage more generosity?
Well, this is where in the conclusion we offer a number of suggestions that are really just came out of our own reflections on the research that we did. So they're more the implications of the study in terms of, you know, how to change or do something different given what we know about what seems to encourage generosity and what seems to be missing in other cases. And one of the things as a mom that I was really interested in is how parents talk to their children, or what do they do with their own children in terms of fostering that spirit of generosity that like Brittany, you know, carries on throughout the life course. And one of the things that I offered in the conclusion in regards to that is this idea of a jar, a donation jar, or something along those lines that's a visual cue, because as I mentioned earlier, for so many people, seeing that visual cue of putting money into something, whether it's an offering plate or something like a jar, you know, seeing that on a regular basis seems to really reinforce that pattern in the background without necessarily having to talk about it all the time.
And so talk about that a little bit more. So if I'm a parent, for example, I just have a jar on my kitchen table, and I contribute to that jar for the cause that I'm going to eventually give to, and that instills more generosity in me and my kids.
Right, that's the idea, is and to involve, you know, depending on the age of the children, to involve them in that in different ways over time, where when they're old enough, they could pick causes that they're interested in supporting or that their friends are doing. And the idea being that, you know, every time everybody as a way to kind of link it to other things that you want to reinforce, for instance, getting a good grade. Some parents, you know, do something like give money to the child when that happens, right, as a way to try to reinforce mm-hmm. it. And so this is kind of a modified version of that, where the idea is, you know, we all get excited about it, but put it in the jar and give it to someone else who's in need.
Do you recommend that we have our kids, you know, you save a dollar, put a dollar aside to give to someone else, and maybe a dollar to buy yourself, you know, buy a toy or something? I mean, like, so the kid is budgeting the allowance, and part of that is a charitable gift?
It's interesting you mention that, because that is actually what my parents did with me. And in doing this research and talking with so many other people and reflecting on how did I learn this, that is, yeah, I think that, I mean, I grew up with that, where anything that I wanted to purchase, I came up with the same amount of the purchase amount. And I do think, you know, so I remember along the way, I mean, I just thought that was normal for the longest time, but then I remember having friends who thought, you know, geez, you have to pay two times as much for a toy that you want. But I just never really thought of it that way, and certainly it has patterned it in, I think, in my own life. I also, though, have learned from other people in doing these interviews that, you know, there are a lot of different kinds of givers, and I think that puts us into what we call the planned giver category. And so there are also a lot of people who like to give in a more kind of spontaneous way, and when they feel really compelled, when there's a cause before them that really moves them. And so there's a lot of ways that people can give without necessarily budgeting it. But at the same time, when we look at the amounts that are given, it is higher dollar amounts that come from the planned and habitual givers. So.
Pam in Wausau is with us. Hello, Pam.
Hi. I just thought I would, I was just listening to what you were saying about, you know, causes and things that motivate giving. And when I was a teenager, I had a baby out of wedlock. And then later on, I'm starting to hear all the debates on the abortion issue. And that kind of spurred me into social giving for a very, you know, controversial issue, which is abortion. But for me, it was on the pro-life side. So I had been giving over the years to Wisconsin Right to Life, National Right to Life, those kinds of things. Well, and that led to giving to political candidates. And but another thing I was going to mention too is that one of the things that has really pushed my giving is social networking for things that come up sort of randomly, like crowdsourcing, and someone is dealing with a you know, serious illness or a death in the family, and that's really also started to, from those personal stories and people who know people who are saying, please go to this crowdfunding source. So that's really, I think, really is kind of a newer.
Yes, thank you so much for bringing that up, Pam. I did want to ask our guest about that. To what do we attribute the success of these crowdsourcing websites, Patricia?
Well, I think that there are two interesting things, you know, in what you're mentioning, Pam, there, and so I'll answer that first. But then I want to also get to what you're talking about with your personal connection and your experience
right.
and how that led to it. But the other part of it, in terms of, you know, what's going on with the crowdsourcing, I think that that a lot of this has to do with looking at the approaches for giving and these giver types that we talk about: impulsive givers, selective givers, planned givers, and habitual givers. And the impulsive givers are the greatest proportion of people who give in the United States. So there are a lot of people who are in that category, and they tend to give in smaller amounts. And so I think you can kind of think about different segments of the population and the kind of untapped potential that's there. And among the impulsive givers, and even to some extent the selective givers, there's a lot of people that can be brought in to give a little bit, which can quickly add up if the right kind of appeal happens. And so I think that is what is happening. You know, when we see these kind of instant outpourings of you know, cumulatively a lot of money, it's because there's this base out there that's willing to give, interested in giving, and hardly actualizing that at all, that if the right kind of appeal and campaign is made, they can get on board. And we see that also with disaster relief, where all of a sudden there's this outpouring of money. And oftentimes it's small contributions by just a lot of people.
And as for Pam getting involved with the Right to Life issue in terms of donations because of her own personal experience of having a baby at a young age, she also then said she moved on to contributing to political candidates who share that view. So that's a different type of giving.
Right, exactly, and this is a shared theme among the callers and many of the people that we interviewed as well, in terms of having something that is an interpersonal, you know, kind of more immediate experience that happens that gets somebody involved in giving to a cause that most directly relates. But then, and some of the other callers shared this too, then the longer people get involved in giving, the more they kind of, you know, branch out and think about other causes and additional ways to make impacts or ways to have kind of more of a ripple in the giving that's happening. So I thought that was a great point to bring in and to share. So thank you.
Yeah, I'm glad she did too. And she did not say that she was like being active politically, like there are protests, you know, in front of clinics or things like that. But you consider that a form of giving as well if you're getting involved politically in an issue.
Absolutely, and political action can take many forms. Sometimes it's people, you know, doing things from their own home by being involved in website campaigns of various types or contacting public officials. And sometimes it's getting out and protesting, or it can be, you know, working on a political campaign. We see all of those as also a form of effort that's intended to benefit collective other people. So.
Let's go to George in Milwaukee. Hello, George.
Yes, hi. I guess I am opposed to the whole idea of the haphazard, individualistic, impulsive giving, and would much prefer to have a society where the giving is actually kind of baked into the system, like you have in a lot of European countries, you know, that spend enough money on, you know, research on diseases or poverty alleviation or educational opportunities. And I think that's an issue that Americans don't really want to face. They feel they like these feel-good kinds of things where they can give $100 to this or that they like, instead of thinking more globally.
Patricia, we're almost out of time.
I would just agree that definitely is the biggest percentage, you know, is the impulsive giver category, and that is part of our American culture, certainly.
Yeah. So, what would you like listeners to take away from your research?
I think one of the biggest things is for nonprofit professionals and for people who are dependent on fundraising is to really see that untapped potential and to think about givers as not one big kind of unified group, that there are these different segments and fundraising that appeals to those segments is likely to be more effective. And then I think individually that, you know, to be inspired by the many, many ways that people give, even when they don't have a great deal of time or money to give away.
Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Patricia Snell-Herzog, co-investigator on the Science of Generosity Initiative. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology and Criminal Justice at the University of Arkansas and co-author of American Generosity, Who Gives and Why. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this program. Thanks to Christy Taylor for on-air direction and to Nyasia Ellison for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we are going to look at American restaurant standards and shine a spotlight on conditions for restaurant workers and how they affect our dining experiences. That's coming up tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.